This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, celebrating the things we learned, the stories we heard, and the amazing veterans we met in 2018 by revisiting excerpts from their experiences. In Carson City, Nevada, we met a 96-year-old submarine veteran named Del Schvichtenberg. He was a licensed pilot before he even turned 16. He'd entered the Navy a year before the attack on Pearl Harbor, and he has long made sure that others remember the 52 submarines the U.S. lost in World War II with nearly 3,500 men aboard. He's also very thankful that his sub, the USS Sandlance, was not added to that list in the spring of 1944.
We were in the Sea of Okhotsk, which is right between the Sea of Japan and the Russian naval base. We had this convoy come through with two Japanese destroyers and two freighters, unmarked, no flags. We sank them. They were both Russian. But in making this attack, we also had icebergs that were floating along and hit the number one periscope, which was the attack scope, Bennett, and it could only go down a few inches. It was jammed, in other words. So the only thing we could do was cut out the upper bearing in order to get a bigger diameter to take care of some of that bend to keep the feather from that scope going over the other scope, rendering it useless.
Well, and I know this is old hat and obvious to you, but most people listening have never been on a submarine. They don't know how periscopes work. They don't know the impact of this. So can you spell out for us why that was such a severe problem to have that periscope bent?
Well, the periscope is the only connection you have with the outside world to know whether there's ships up there, where they're at, airplanes, whatever you can see. The airplanes usually came in with the sun, and you didn't see them anyhow.
Well, having that periscope bent put severe limitations on the operability of this sub and put all your lives in danger.
That is correct. With the bent one, it puts a feather of water up over the second one, which rendered it useless. So that was the reason we had to get the bent one down to where that feather of water would not go over the second periscope. We had two periscopes. In case one was out of commission, we had another one we could fall back on. One was an attack, which was a very small lens at the top, and the second one was a little stubbier, so there were two different kinds. One of them had radar on it, and the other one didn't. The attack didn't.
But so you guys have to stay on the surface while you try to fix this, right?
That is correct.
And that puts you in danger.
Yes, we had an air attack. We just barely got up on top of the periscope shears. This was when the skipper took it out 25 miles from the coast of Japan. My second class was an Indian, and he had a good eyesight, and he spotted this plane coming in from Japan, a Coast Guard patrol. So by the time we got down going through the conning tower hatch, that was the first radar contact we had with it, and that was 10 miles. Well, at the speed those Zeros flew, 10 miles don't take very long.
So you're up on top of the boat trying to fix this periscope, and there's a plane coming in, so you have to hustle down below and hope they don't hit you?
Yeah. And we were up about 45 feet above the waterline, and the lookouts were halfway in between.
So what happened when the plane came in?
He went past, came back in with the sun where he could see us. We were actually too close to him when he came over the first time. So he turned around and came in with the sun, and they could see you down to 100 feet, a silhouette, on a good sunshiny day. And he dropped two bombs, near misses, but he got rid of his bomb load.
Well, I think the obvious question is, How did he miss you? Weren't you a sitting duck?
Not really. We had probably 100 feet of water above us.
So you were able to submerge a little bit because you saw him coming?
Oh, yeah. No. We submerged immediately. And like I said, when we cleared the conning tower, the radar had him at 10 miles. And then they had to get the lookouts down and the OD down. We went right on down to 100 feet.
So if your buddy, your second class man, hadn't spotted it when he did, you wouldn't have been down 100 feet.
Probably not.
And you might not be here.
Yeah, right.
So that plane's gone, but you don't know when another one's coming?
The captain went out to 50 miles then, and we moved south to a new area anyway. In other words, we didn't lose too much time between the time that we were working on the periscope to the next station, which was right off of Yokohama Bay.
And so, to actually fix it, what did you have to do?
Well, we had to go back Pearl Harbor.
But in the moment, how did you remedy the situation?
We cut out the upper bushing, which was about a 30-inch bronze bushing, which kept that periscope steady when it was raised. And our periscope depth was roughly 60 feet. So from 45 to 60, there were about 15 feet of periscope.
So again, you have to surface, and you guys go up there?
We had to drill little holes. The only equipment we had was what we left with, and that was electric drill and a bunch of drill bits and cold chisels and hammers.
So a little bit at a time?
Yeah, one drill, and we'd get a pocket full of those drills, go down and sharpen them, and then go back up. And this is in the middle of a snowstorm.
You're talking about this like it's no big deal, but you've just been bombed by an airplane. You've got to get this fixed. You don't know if there are other planes coming in or a ship could spot you and fire at you. You're wearing out drill bit after drill bit trying to get a little piece of this off at a time. And it's snowing on you the whole time?
That is correct. That was very miserable as far as weather was concerned.
How long did it take you guys with a little, you know, fraction of an inch at a time to get that done?
2 days and two nights we worked on that periscope, and fortunately we weren't attacked after that first day.
And did you get any sleep in those 2 days?
Few minutes nap.
What was going through your mind while you're working on that? I mean, because you don't know if you're ever going to get it done or if you're going to finish in time or if you're going to survive this.
We didn't have any choice. It was going to take so long in order to drill two strips of that bushing. We had to take it off in two pieces, and so we had to make two cuts. I was on one side and Cabby was on the other, and we were drilling and chiseling and then spreading, and we had jack screws would help to pull this thing up and spread it out. We had to make those from scratch. We were just fortunate. On the way leaving Portsmouth, we were walking back to the ship, and here was a trash barrel outside the machine shop with a bunch of miscellaneous metal in it. And we just happened to pull out two or three pieces, long pieces, maybe 2 or 3 feet long, of half-inch steel. And that was our jack screws. We had to shred those and use those. Then we're just fortunate that we took it out of that trash barrel before we left Portsmouth.
And again, I don't want to exaggerate here, but it kind of sounds like you were faced with an impossible task that you didn't have the right tools to accomplish.
First of all, you need a crane to get that scope out of the way in the first place.
Which you didn't have.
We didn't have, no. And we didn't have very good weather. We had a lot against us.
It kind of reminds me of that question, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. I mean, you were eating a pretty big elephant there.
That is correct. The hardest way you possibly could do it.
And were there moments within those couple days, as the snow's falling, your hands are freezing up, you're trying to drill through this thing, that you thought it's not going to happen?
Those are the times when you took the drill bits and went down and sharpened them and maybe grabbed a couple winks of sleep, and a cup of coffee or something.
Well, I have to imagine when you finally got it out of there and remedied that problem, that had to feel pretty satisfying.
It did. It did the job. And we were able to complete the patrol run. We sank a good number of ships after that. We got a cruiser and we got a tanker and we got a transport out of a convoy. And the cruiser that we got, the torpedo went under the target, got on the other side, and that's where the cruiser was. We got the cruiser, but wasn't really shooting at him in the first place. Anyway, we got three ships. We'd wasted six torpedoes, three one day at a Q-boat and three the next day at another Q-boat. The torpedo depth was set at 3 feet, and they watched it go underneath them. And so that was one of the first clues that we could go back, or the captain could go back to the admiral and say the torpedoes are running deep. Because we were having torpedo problems. Plus, we were trying to shoot it too far away. We fired at roughly 1,000 yards, a half mile. First part of the war, they were figuring they had 2 miles of torpedo run. Well, you might have had 2 miles of torpedo run, but not at the speed you're going.
You know, I'm thinking I should read your citation here. They gave you the Bronze Star, signed by Admiral Nimitz, and the citation says, for meritorious service in action, when his outstanding performance of duty in working 2 days and nights on top of the periscope shears, part of the time in a heavy snowstorm, and under the threat of Japanese air attack, cutting away the upper bearing to allow the lowering of number one periscope, which had bent and jammed in the raised position, aided his commanding officer materially in the sinking of over 28,000 tons and the damaging of 6,000 tons. And maybe it's just me, but I'm thinking the bigger impact there, yeah, you sank a lot of ton of enemy shipping, but didn't you guys also save the lives of everybody on that boat?
Oh, yes.
That's a pretty big deal.
Well, the third patrol was more dangerous than this first one, but none of them were a picnic, let's put it that way. Every time we sank a ship, we were bound to get at least 25 depth charges. And if there were two destroyers, at one point, we were held down 15 hours and 105 depth charges. You don't sleep doing that. That was on the first patrol run after we got to Yokohama Bay.
Well, it sure seems like a helpless feeling when that's going on. I've got to ask you, though, I'm looking at a picture here of a young sailor with a Bronze Star pinned to his chest and a pretty good look of satisfaction on his face. How did you find out they were giving you the Bronze Star, and what was that like to have an admiral pin it on your uniform?
Well, it's an honor. You feel appreciated.
I guess another question that comes to mind is, how exhausted were you after those 2 days and nights in that snowstorm?
Well, after we got warmed up, we got a good night's sleep. But then we went right on into the Q-boats and then the convoy. And we were forced down at 2 o'clock in the morning in the middle of a battery charge. We surfaced a couple hours later and we were forced down again with the aerial zeros. Then the sonar reported propellers all around us. We were right in the middle of the convoy. We had 8 torpedoes left and fired all 8, and we got 3 ships.
There seems to be a recurring theme as I listen to some of your stories. You had a lot working against you. Have you ever looked back at everything you did in World War II and say, how in the world did I make it through all of that?
I consider myself very lucky. Like I said, I think I've had a guardian angel looking after me several times in my lifetime.
Hard to argue with that sentiment from Del Schwichtenberg of Carson City, Nevada. Again, you can link to that original interview and more than 500 others at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, a fighter pilot who earned the Navy Cross. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.